Okay, the first question, could you please clarify the difference between one being detached versus being indifferent or apathetic? The difference between being detached and apathetic. There's a phrase that I am accustomed to using. It's not from some scripture directly, but detached caring. Something that devotees that take care of other devotees have to learn. Or parents have to learn, or you know, like someone that's taking charge of the well-being of another. Attachment is thinking of oneself as the cause of the result, or attached to fruitive results. And Krishna advises that one should not think of oneself as the cause of the results of your work. But if you are thinking of yourself as the cause of the results of your work, your activity, or something, then you're attached. So detachment is, I'm not the cause of the result. I'm a servant. This is my language. Our department is serving, and Krishna's department is controlling. And we don't take charge of Krishna's department, thinking that we're the controllers or we're the cause of the results. That's Krishna's department. If we think wrongly that we're the cause of results, then we're attached. So detachment is recognizing your position as a servant. But when you're recognizing your position as a servant, you're not apathetic. You care. You want Krishna to be pleased. You want Krishna's devotees to be pleased. You want the devotees to be happy. And sometimes, as much as you try, devotee X is unhappy. Like I explained, you know, sometimes people have to like find something to worry about because they're worriers. They have to be in distress, otherwise they're not happy. What can you do? Try to tell, like, help them see that you don't have to be in distress to be happy. It's not a requirement. It's not natural. Anyway, so apathetic is I don't care, and detached is I'm not the cause of the result. But I care. And therefore, out of caring, out of compassion, out of concern for the welfare of others, I'm making a sincere effort, but I'm not the cause of the result. There's the detachment factor. Krishna is the cause of the result. Part B is, how do we recognize where we are detached versus apathetic? Well, attached is, I'm very enthusiastic when the circumstances are favorable, and when the circumstances are unfavorable, I lose my enthusiasm. And apathetic is, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. just apathetic. Let's say the contrast of both of these is steady. As we were discussing the stages of bhakti, and when one reaches the stage of nishtha, or steady faith, one is steady in one's execution of devotional service. Even it may be regulative, it's not yet spontaneous, but whatever are the impurities of the heart, the anarthas in the heart, they're of such a modest level Nashta prayeshu abhadreshu, they're practically gone, nearly gone. Whatever residual presence there are, the bhakti is so strong it just keeps going. And it surpasses whatever obstacles or impurities may arise or may be there. And if one's service is unsteady or intermittent, enthusiastic, complacent, then that's attached. And apathetic is just, there isn't even anything on the radar screen. Just flat. Could you please elaborate further on the phenomena of perceiving Krishna indirectly? I fear this might sometimes lead to speculation. Well, all kinds of things might sometimes lead to speculation, even directly or indirectly. So the antidote for speculation is we're guided by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So let's take an example. Supposing I may not be so clear, but I have a sense that indirectly Krishna's acting here. So we take that, we hold it up to the light of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And if it matches, fine. If it doesn't match, we trash it. Just like that. And sometimes we may see that there is match, and others, like 10 others, there's no match at all. And we trash it. In other words, we consult with other learned personalities in order to see if something is... But the idea of indirectly, it's not born of speculation at all. It's... A principle that, like I was discussing, use this example, like an arrangement of providence, providential arrangement, something. Like, it rained very heavily on Friday night. That's not speculation, it rained very heavily on Friday night. And they were forecasting it was going to rain yesterday and today, and it's been a sunny day. Krishna's mercy. We had lots of children, it would have been difficult had the children been inside. Krishna's mercy. It's not necessarily that because we're having an event, Krishna stopped the rain, but Krishna's mercy. The indirectly is by inference. An example that Prabhupada would give is called a teleological argument. By inference, one can understand there's a controller, because things are so, at a precise time. The sun rises on the eastern horizon. At a precise, predictable time, the sun sets. And if the sun, the distance between the earth and the sun was some, very small fraction different, then, it would be cold, or everything would freeze, or everything would be burst into flames. There are things there's order within the universe. By inference, There's something that's causing that order in the universe. It's not random. It's not accidental. It's not chance. There's order in the universe. It's inference. We can understand the unseen hand of God, although we can't see it. We can infer the presence of God. We know on the authority of Scripture, Maya Jakshena Prakriti, Krishna's overseeing Adyaksha, material nature. So it's confirmed, the unseen hand of God. So the indirectly is understood and it's confirmed according to Scripture. There's a logic and reason and inferential plausibility or likelihood. The other explanations are not plausible or likely. So we can infer. And then it's confirmed by Scripture. Like that. So we don't, it's not, if there's some tendency in someone to speculate, the antidote for that is Guru Sadhu Shastra. Provided one is willing to be submissive to Guru Sadhu Shastra, then they can be checked. Tendency can be checked. How does one identify enjoyment from success in devotional service compared to satisfaction and happiness from pleasing Guru and Krishna? Well, here's a real simple one, rule of thumb. That which increases devotional service, that's reality, that's the internal potency. That which diminishes devotional service, that's maya or illusion. So if one's devotional service over a long period of time is steadily increasing, and the happiness that one experiences, regardless of the external circumstances, is steadily increasing, that's due to the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. And if one's happiness is intermittent, sometimes up, sometimes crashing, that's not a spiritual happiness, whatever that happiness was. Or, at best, it's a reflection of spiritual happiness. Can one study Srimad Bhagavatam parallel to Bhakti Shastri? Or should Srimad Bhagavatam be read after completing Bhakti Shastri? Depends on who's asking the question. Depends on their level of Krishna consciousness. Depends on how much time you have. If you're full-time brahmachari, no problem. And if you have limited time, better you focus on one thing and sequentially, because Prabhupada laid it out, Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav, etc., etc. So there was a reason behind that and a systematic study, because Bhakti Shastri is not just reading Bhagavad Gita, it's a very careful, systematic study of, under guidance of a qualified person systematically studying. So that's preferred. Learn ABCs before you, you know, learn the undergraduate study before you go to the graduate study. That's preferred. On the other hand, in temples, Prabhupada didn't have systematic study of it, morning Bhagavatam class, evening Bhagavad Gita class, no problem. Read something from both, no problem. But if you're going to undergo a systematic study of, that sequence is better. The four essential devotional texts, the undergraduate study level, and then the graduate study level. That's best. We got a lot of pieces of paper here. We heard that many of the devotional practices involve hearing. For example, you hear yourself chant, you hear class, etc. What would a person do if he or she was deaf? What what would they do? What would be their way of purification? One answer is Braille. That's blind. Even if you hear, but you know the instrument is broken, the sound vibration acts spiritually. The cognitive faculties may not be working if one is deaf. Then one can read. Supposing one isn't also blind, one can read. Preferred is to hear. But if one can't hear, then one can read. And even still hear, but happening on a spiritual level only and not happening on the cognitive level. Get the second one. How do you make your living space into Vrindavan?
You know how you were speaking about how we have to break the 5 days of
living. Yeah. So how do you do it? At an appropriate time in one's spiritual life. You can start with visits to Vrindavan. And then further extended visits to Vrindavan and further extended visits to Vrindavan and just, you know, see if that suits. And in the course of time, some way to maintain oneself and stay for a longer time in Vrindavan with some service. And what I'm indicating here is gradually. At the right time. When describing this one of these five items of living in the holy dham, Mathura Vas or Mathura Vasi, to become a resident of Mathura or Vrindavan, Vrajavasi. If one is, regularly Prabhupada would say, if one is not able to do that, then one should think of Vrindavan. And by thinking of Vrindavan, you're in Vrindavan. You make the place where you are Vrindavan by consciousness. Conversely, one can go to Vrindavan and not enter into Vrindavan if one is not in a right consciousness. You're still on the surface and not in the dham yet. So what's the eligibility to live in Vrindavan? Mercy. Be a recipient of mercy and purify oneself gradually. To reside in Vrindavan. And even in residing in Vrindavan, following the example of Srila Prabhupada, as not his teachings as well as his example, although he considered Vrindavan his home, he was lots of time out of the home, traveling throughout the land to bring the message of Krishna consciousness to others. He was in the preaching field away from home. So we may think of, you know, our home is where the heart is. Go through that t-shirt, I left my heart in Vrindavan. Home is where the heart is. So your heart can be in Vrindavan, just like Govinda, because he spent so many years living in Vrindavan. His heart is in Vrindavan, wherever he is, and he's taking, you know, the valuable association that he received from Indra to other people. That's his contemplation. the holy name and the training that he received, and he's giving that to others. And it's too hot in Vrindavan in the summer. Way too hot. You know, it's like his body was bursting in sun blisters staying in Vrindavan. He just can't stay in Vrindavan as much as he would want to. If a relationship consistently brings hurt and grief to me, and as a consequence to my husband, what is the best possible way to deal with the hurt and the devotee? And also, that can at least maintain a thread of respect for the devotee. Several things. Prabhupada spoke almost every time when Peter Burwash, as the keynote speaker at the Festival of Inspiration, there's two or three things that he says every time. Answer your telephone. Put shoes away. Don't just leave shoes scattered around. And, you know, greet guests warmly when people come to your temple, just like, don't just walk by and, you know, you're busy doing some important service, but receive guests that come. So that's, you know, hospitality is one message. And another message is, because Prabhupada directly instructed him, and he describes the detail of what happened, but don't blame the instrument of your karma when something bad happens. If something comes your way that's hurtful. In his particular case, he donated $50 and or something, whatever, maybe it was more, maybe it was $500, and the temple president ran away with his $500 the next day. Then he went, you know, informed Prabhupada, and Prabhupada's reply was, don't blame the instrument of your karma, which is a very surprising response to give to somebody who just, you know, instead of saying, oh, that's really unfortunate, and consoling the individual, he didn't do that. Prabhupada gave a similar reply. I've heard Bhakti Tirtha Swami describe this. It's like, I could, because of time, I can't do the long story. But he graduated in the honors position as the valedictorian of his class at Princeton University, and the, whatever you call that, the chairman of the student organization, or student government, whatever that position is called. You know, he came from a ghetto and he was on his way to like a glowing career. Right? Jagannath, am I on the money here? Yeah. And he, you know, in the course of his college life, he received a book on some devotees. I know who the devotee was. A book distribution party from New York went to Princeton University. He got a book, and he read the book, and he wanted to meet the author of the book, and he met Prabhupada, and he associated with the devotees, and he found that, much to his surprise, in this spiritual organization there was racial discrimination. Because he expected, you know, these are people that aren't going to have that problem. And so he wanted to bring this to Prabhupada's attention. And it was a very important, I mean, it's much better when you hear the whole story, but it was a very important moment for him in his spiritual life, because here's his guru, and he wants to hear what Prabhupada has to say about people in his own spiritual organization that have, you know, racial discrimination. And here's a black man that's, you know, they're discriminating against. And he wants to serve his guru. So, I may not have it exactly right, but on the something like, this is not very good, but if you have a problem with this, you're no better than they are. And it wasn't like a slap in the face, it was like, wow, It was wake up. Because the problem is seeing on the platform of the body, and if you're seeing on the platform of the body, you're on the same platform. So don't be on that platform. Be on the transcendental platform. And that, you know, that didn't cause him to recoil. It caused him to... That was it. Full shelter. This is my guru. He's right. Meaning, he's right. So if someone, by responding to this question by saying, you know, it's your fault. Wait a minute. It's not like our fault, it's our karma. So when something comes your way, here's, I'm walking down the path of life, and something comes that's hurtful. Now, first thing that one should do is think of Krishna. My dear Lord Krishna, what is it that you would like me to understand from this circumstance? What service is that you would like me to do given this circumstance? I mean, if you check in with Krishna, then it makes the hurt become something else altogether. There's this saying, it's not a scriptural saying, but it's there's a lot of wisdom in it. If one can understand the sufferings of another person and because of the sufferings they're going through, why they might do something that might be hurtful to others, we could easily forgive them. Got it? If somebody is doing something that's hurtful, what are they going through that's causing them, instead of kindness, they're doing something hurtful? What's their pain? Why are they what is it that they're undergoing that's causing them to act this way, or speak this way, or carry on this way, conduct their life this way? What is the suffering that they have endured? If you can understand what that is, you can easily forgive that person. So one of the rules of not getting drawn into the modes of material nature is to maintain a spiritual perspective or a spiritual conception. Minimally, forgiveness. Forgiveness is a quality of goodness. So even if someone continues to do something hurtful, you can continue to forgive them. You may want to not get too close to that person because they're hurtful. Just, you know, because of what mean spirit that they have within them because of all of the hurt that they're undergoing, I can't bear that hurt. But if you're Narada Muni, you go seek that person out and give them mercy. And even if they, you know, scratch you or bite you or curse you, you continue to extend compassion because you're Narada Muni. And it's an overwhelming condition where someone just, it's unconditional what they wish for your well-being. So how one responds in a direct interaction with a hurtful person depends on your capacity. But at least, minimally, be forgiving. Doesn't mean like that. Forgiving doesn't mean the behavior that was hurtful is okay. But you can forgive them and still understand that behavior is hurtful. It's something I wouldn't do, but I can forgive the other person for that hurtful behavior. And understand they're struggling. What can I do to help them in their struggling condition? Maybe the best thing for me to do is just pray for their well-being. And prayer is powerful. I don't have any other opportunity for intervention directly because I'm very limited. But Krishna is unlimited, and Krishna, please help this person. Pray for their well-being, not pray that they get their, you know, get smacked in return. But pray for their well-being. whatever it is that's causing them their hurt and therefore causing them to be hurtful, the victim is now being the perpetrator. So I'm not going to be caught up in the cycle of victim-perpetrator. I'm going to recognize that they're suffering. What can I do? In the course of this weekend, I had a discussion with one devotee on specifically on this topic. Extend some kindness to that person in whatever one's capacity is. And you'll hear an earful of what their pain is. And then this other message, the Peter Burwash message from Prabhupada, of don't blame the victim, the instrument of your own karma. So there's something in the background over here that's bringing this difficult circumstance fructifying today. There's something about back there that's bringing this problem today. And I accept whatever this thing that's happening today, as somehow it's deserving. Like Lord Brahma's prayer, Tat te nukampam susamikshamano. That is, I'll accept the reactions for my past misdeeds as my deserve. But one thing is, let my mind not budge one fraction of an inch from the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, wishing to serve Him. For by so doing, one will inherit the property of the Personality of Godhead, or that is, one will go back to Godhead, one will enter the kingdom of God by that disposition. Or as Prabhupada said many times, referring to the biblical quote, the meek shall inherit the kingdom of God. So that position of forgiveness and humility, trinadapi sunichena, one can maintain that position, that person is eligible to enter the kingdom of God. But let my mind not budge one inch from the service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here's a circumstance, how am I best to serve Him? Maybe it's any number of things. Maybe it's just to be tolerant. Maybe it's to be forgiving. Maybe it's to say some kind words. Maybe it's to just back off. Maybe it's so many things, maybe. But let it be in a mood of serving Krishna. You stay in the spiritual position, despite the difficult circumstance. Easier to say than to do, but that's what to do. I don't get this one. CMB said, perfect your life and then spread this message to others. Who wrote this one? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, perfect your life and then spread this message to others, for spreading this message of Krishna consciousness to others. It looks like, for me, it's going to take forever to perfect. How can I prepare for this service? I think I get what you're saying, Yasky. You begin wherever you are. Wherever that is. Each one of us. So, if it's here, here, or here. So, your striving is, make your life perfect. And meanwhile, whether you're perfect or not perfect yet, okay. Whether you're perfect or not perfect yet, you extend whatever that is that you have received to others. Whatever that is. Whatever you received, you extend that to others. and strive to make your life perfect. They're not mutually exclusive. Don't do anything until you become perfect. Okay. At the time of initiation, a disciple should completely surrender. Diksha kale something something. Atma samarpan. But we also hear surrender is a process. Does it mean I will surrender 10% following some instructions, not following some others today, and 20% tomorrow, etc.? And something after 100% I can be a suitable candidate for initiation. I think that's a similar question to the one that was asked. Two things. Again, each of us is endowed with a certain capacity, and so to our capacity we should extend. Then another is, each of us has a capacity, and what Krishna is looking for is not so much what we're extending, but what we're holding back. From our temple president GBC meeting, Prabhupada, Dharma was from Miami, was speaking about this. Prabhupada wrote him one letter in his life, and Prabhupada was giving the example of Kulavichar Sridhar, where he was very poor. He had clothes that had more holes than they had clothes. And his roof was more holes than it was roof. So during the rainy season, he might as well be outside. But that's what he had the capacity for, because he was so poor. But each day, Kulavichar Sridhar, whatever earnings he had, 50% of his earnings, he would worship Mother Ganges, and the other 50%, which was next to nothing, that would maintain him. So using that reference, Prabhupada was speaking not about giving money, but he was speaking about Dharma's ability to distribute books nicely, which was next to nothing. And others were distributing books like anything. And compared to him, his service was not pleasing to his spiritual master. But Prabhupada made it very clear, what was pleasing to his spiritual master, what was pleasing to Prabhupada, was that whatever capacity Dharma had, he was trying. Like the classic of in Ramayana, when they're building the bridge to Lanka, depending upon which version of Ramayana you read, the squirrel or the spider were throwing little pebbles, little pieces of sand to help with the bridge. And Hanuman said, get out of the way. And Ram said, they're doing their best, just as you are. And I accept both. So the percentage of surrender is more dependent upon what your capacity is, more than, you know, what you're doing. Because if your capacity is greater and you're doing very modest, you're holding back. So whatever the best model for sincere devotees, let's assume that we're trying to be sincere devotees, best model is whatever capacity Krishna has given, extend that fully to Krishna, to your capacity. And what happens is Krishna increases your capacity. And then as Krishna increases your capacity, he also gives you more to do. Ask Dhruva. More to do than you could do in 10 lifetimes. more to do, and it's like overwhelming. You have to like either cry or laugh. So much to do. I know that feeling too. And sincere devotees in different positions know that feeling. Just some of us get, you know, little special mercy, and it's an overwhelming amount to do. That's nice. And according to your capacity, you call out to Krishna, "Krishna, please help." And some little ability to, and capacity, and so the best model is, to your capacity, you offer it all to Krishna. And supposing, you know, you're not so surrendered, you offer whatever you can offer to Krishna. And strive towards the goal, a little bit like this question of striving for perfection. You strive for the goal to your capacity and pray to Krishna to increase your capacity. And Krishna will increase your capacity gradually over time. And when one is in that position of sincerity and sustaining that position of sincerity, that's when initiation should take place. Not that one is, you know, a pure devotee or something, an uttama adhikari, and then you can be initiated. That would be nice if everyone that was initiated was an uttama adhikari. That's not the standard that Prabhupada set for us. It's specifically, one lecture I remember Prabhupada saying, specifically, initiation is for those who are very sincere. Anyone can chant, anyone can come and participate, but initiation is for those who are very sincere and have sustained that sincere effort for some period of time. They may be initiated. But then they have responsibility as initiated devotees to represent properly. Okay. I want to know about compassion. Particularly, how can I start cultivating compassion? It's seeming far. It seems far to even understand. Well, this is similar. The context is different, but the essence is quite similar. You start wherever you are. You got to start somewhere. You start with what you have. So, okay, I'll say I don't have a lot of compassion. That's where I am. Now, how do I make it grow? And, you know, it's like anything, you invest conscious attention into that something. And you associate with persons that have that quality, in this case, compassion. And you read or hear descriptions about persons who are very compassionate. And you think about those persons, and you glorify those persons, and you remember those persons, and that way you're associating with those persons, and that quality comes out. It grows. It's innate. Compassion is a mode of goodness quality, but it's also a spiritual quality. The mode of goodness manifestation is a reflection, and the spiritual manifestation is the real thing. It's not depending upon circumstance. We're not compassionate for the people who suffer the in Japan, or when there's a calamity and we kill the innocent animal. It's like there's something wrong. That's not what it's not a spiritual conception. Compassion is compassion. So we ultimately, by taking shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, compassion will awaken. It will follow, because it's a spiritual quality. By Krishna Eka Sharana, by taking full shelter of Krishna alone, that quality of compassion and all other qualities will grow. I don't get this question. Under what circumstance / criteria does a Swami decide to be a Shiksha Guru versus a Diksha Guru? Could you play? Whoever, Bhakti Govind. Could you explain that one, please? Supposing what? Supposing you're a Swami.
Right. How do I decide if I should, on what factor would I decide that I want to be a Siksha Guru or a Diksha? Could I just say that, okay, I don't want to...
That was a joke. Well, it's not exactly that the language is a little confusing for me personally, because it's not exactly we decide. That's why it's a little confusing for me. Let's seated right next to you is Jai Keshava. And he's extending himself to many persons. He's doing that because he understands that Krishna has given him some gift. And something he likes doing, something that he's gifted by Krishna to do. Other people appreciate, so he does that because it's like that's devotional service that's suited for him. He didn't decide, you know, I'm going to be that. He just joined the Hare Krishna movement and started doing some service and started doing that, along with so many other things that he also did, and found that was something that he was gifted at doing. Krishna helped him do that service. So he didn't decide it. Then, you know, supposing some passage of time and some persons are like not just inspired by his kindness and compassion and the gift that Krishna has given him, but it goes to some deeper level. So what would he do? He would go and consult with those persons that are guiding him and say, you know, what do I do? And depending upon what they would say, that would help him. He's going to also make a decision, but by the guidance, you know, it would help him understand what Krishna wants him to do. Yeah, go ahead.
So why not just Diksha Guru? All that Diksha Guru also does. So why is there a specific Diksha Guru who doesn't initiate? So what's the reason for that?
The reason for that is, there's a someone may feel they're not. There's an added responsibility. It's not worlds of difference, but there's an added responsibility, and someone may feel I'm comfortable taking this kind of responsibility. And I'm not comfortable with that kind of responsibility. And there's, you know, if someone comes to me and says, would you be my Diksha Guru? I may feel comfortable to say, so-and-so, here's five so-and-sos, and I have full confidence in them, kindly approach them as Diksha Guru. I'll continue to help you in your spiritual life in the same way. I wish to not do that service. I know one devotee who has done like that. And it's like his heart. It's his relationship with Krishna and Prabhupada. And that's, one is something that inspires and the other is something, he makes a face when you talk to him about it. He doesn't care to do that. And, you know, there's maybe other factors with some individual that they may say, I think it's really important that somebody, that our society understands in general, that Shiksha Guru is a very important position. And it's underemphasized, so I'd like to just be Shiksha Guru and not this other one. Do the same shelter giving, caring, extending, instructing, and so on. I'll share something, not on, exactly on this topic, but it's similar. I didn't understand how sannyas, you know, you're using the term a swami. I didn't understand how it worked in ISKCON. One day somebody came and told me, hey, you've been recommended for sannyas. And, you know, you're eligible to take sannyas. And my reply was, why do I need to take sannyas? Well, you know, you've been recommended, that's why. I said, well, that's not a reason. I said, you know, I'm happy being a brahmachari. I'm not thinking, well, I want to hold off here because I might want to get married someday. That's like out of the question. There's no, not a thought like that. But, you know, I'm happy. I'm doing lots of service. Tons and tons of service. And hey, I see lots of people that are really eager to get sannyas, and I don't think that's good. I'm happy being a brahmachari. I said, okay. So I remained a brahmachari. Then other people were telling me, you should take sannyas. Why should I take sannyas? Well, it's, you know, it'll expand your service. Look, I got a lot of service. No, but it's good for a society that, you know, it just, it came up the next year. Then it came up the next year. And by, you know, over the passage of 2 years, I had done some reflecting and some reading, and I could understand the area of service particular to preaching becomes enhanced by sannyas. So I said, okay. It wasn't like, you know, like your question here. What criteria did you use to decide to become sannyas? I was ambitious. I wanted respect. You carry one of those sticks and you get respect. Something that's, so the right criterion is something that suits your nature. And it's good to have people that are close to you and can guide you and help you understand your nature even better than you might understand your nature. And then do that which is suited to your nature. Is that right? What's the next one? Oh. What criterion are the deities named? Inspiration. Krishna prompts, and then Prabhupada says, these deities will be named Radha Madan Mohan, Radha Govinda, Radha Gopinath, Radha Damodaran. And so it was. Okay? We have 20 minutes and a lot of paper. I mentioned I am not comfortable to study Srimad Bhagavatam, but I like to hear stories. So Krishna book is something I read, but I am conflicted since 10th canto is not supposed to be read before 1st canto and 2nd canto. I hope to study Srimad Bhagavatam one day. That's the end of the question. Okay, that's good. For us to do any service, like work, do we need to be present with Krishna? Well, if you're going to do devotional service and go to work, then yes. Yes. Be present with Krishna means to, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. So by thinking of Krishna, you're present with Krishna. Or Krishna is present with you in the form of your thought of him. My question is on time. As you said, that eternal time is the background of everything, and what we experience is relative to that eternal time. So, I'm ready for some speculative question here. So, in spiritual world, does that mean that there's no conception of eternity? Because we have to wait and get there and find out. Because eternity is neither beginning nor ending in scope of time. How do events take place there? That's the essence of the question. It's inconceivable for us to even try to think of events that have no beginning and end. Because we only know of events that have beginning and end. Like, you know, the retreat's almost over. And we're now sitting, many people have left and we're in the temple room and we're going to leave the temple room. Before we were in the temple room, we were somewhere else having lunch. And now we're, so there's events that are events in time. But what's an event that has no beginning and has no end and it's eternal? We don't have any experience, at least to our memory. We don't have any experience of that. So we can only think of events within time. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes language itself is limited because it describes things as we experience and as we know it. So how do you describe an eternal event? You use language that's temporal. So it's limited. It can't reach that. Our mind can't reach that. It's beyond the scope of the mind. You can't get your mind around eternality. You can make an affinity sign that goes like that and ask a child, where does it begin and where does it end? And it doesn't have a beginning and end. Nonetheless, those events are real, as opposed to these events which are a reflection of the real or imaginary or illusion. These events are not real events, those events are real events. They're eternal. Jiva Goswami says that in his Sandarbhas that if one does not accept that the personality of Godhead has inconceivable potencies, then there's no question of understanding even the fundamental, most fundamental thing about God. That's like a very simple statement, but you know, unpack it and it's very powerful. If God, there's something that God doesn't have, then how is God? So he has that which is inconceivable. That's his divinity. He's not limited like us, he's unlimited. He has inconceivable potencies. So part of those inconceivable potencies is this one, eternal events that to us are inconceivable. So one can't sit here in one's armchair, rocking chair, pulling one's chin and scratching one's head, trying to imagine what eternal events are, or eternal time is, or the experience of time in the spiritual world. That's speculation. That's a sheer waste of time. One will never understand that way. But rather, if one approaches through the medium of devotional service and tries to serve Krishna with our temporal body, senses, and mind, and purify them, then there's some chance to understand Krishna and eternal events, the eternal pastimes, the inconceivable potencies of the Supreme Lord, like eternal time, Kala Shakti. And through the agency of eternal time, he's performing events eternally, of which this material world is but a reflection. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that hardly anyone knows him in full. Does that mean hardly I will reach him? Maybe. If yes, then what about those who become perfected? I don't get the question. Who's the author? Hardly anyone knows me in truth. Yeah. Is there anyone that does know him in truth, full? He's speaking of persons that know Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschid yatati siddhaye yatatamapi siddhanam kaschin mam veti tatvataha. Hardly one knows me in truth. That is to say, they may, of many, many thousands of persons, hardly one is interested in spiritual, eternal reality. Of persons who know Brahman, hardly one knows Bhagavan, factually. They may know the dictionary definition of it, they hardly know. Is it possible for the tiny jiva to perfectly know the unlimited Supreme? That's an easy question to answer. Can the limited know the unlimited perfectly? That's an easy question to answer. No. Let's ask this one. Can the unlimited Krishna know Krishna perfectly? Here's what our acharyas say. If Krishna tries to understand himself, after completing the inventory about himself, he's expanded. Even Krishna doesn't know himself perfectly. What to speak? So, what that verse is referring to is those who have a spiritual conception, Brahman conception. Hardly one knows Bhagavan factually. And even that, it's limited. Okay? In doing any service, the goal should be to please Krishna. But whatever service I do, there is tendency for some subconscious adoration, distinction, etc. How to get rid of that? Keep trying. Striving for the goal. I call it the one-pocket program instead of the two-pocket program. So much for Krishna, so much for me, so much for Krishna, so much for me. Just keep one pocket. Everything for Krishna. I've told this story before. During our temple president and GBC meeting, we decided at the beginning that the Prabhupada disciples would sit together side by side in a little semicircle and speak from their experience with Srila Prabhupada something that was very moving and helped them grow in Krishna consciousness. So one of the things that I shared was at one year the Radha Damodar party, I think it was 1975, not sure, 76 maybe, we went together to the Mayapur festival and the Vrindavan festival. And Tamal Krishna Raj, being the personality he was, he arranged for a private darshan to encourage all the Sankirtan devotees. So Prabhupada agreed. And in addition, he arranged for a $50,000 donation to be given to Prabhupada. We didn't, at least I didn't know about it, but when we were all sitting in Prabhupada's darshan room in Mayapur, those of you that have been there, you know that room. And he was in the back room. It is because there are two adjoining rooms. They're small rooms. And we were all seated there, just chanting japa, and then Prabhupada came out. Very ostentatiously and ceremoniously, Tamal Krishna Maharaj placed a stack of $100 bills like that on Prabhupada's desk. Like, you know, notice me was written all over it. And because it could have been like a check, but instead it was like a big stack of $100 bills. Notice me. And I was seated, it's a rectangular room, and Prabhupada's desk was also rectangular. I was seated right on the corner as he came in, you know, from his doorway into the room and sat down. And to see Prabhupada, it was like I was looking right past the $100 bill stack. And I was, you know, I was watching him very carefully, and I wasn't thinking about this till later, but I noticed as he looked around the room and was having eye contact with everybody and interactions, he never once did his eyes even go to that stack of bills. The message was, you can't buy me. But he purposely, when he stood up, the darshan was over, and he was walking out of the room, he stopped and directly spoke audibly so we could hear to his servant, see that this money goes to print such and such book. It's at the printer. We need the money for the printing. And then he paused and smiled, tilted his head and said, with my meals, can I have honey instead of sugar? A little sense gratification. Then he laughed and walked out. Meaning everything for Krishna. Not, you know, so much for Krishna, so much for me. Everything for Krishna. And it was, you know, certainly consistent with his teachings, but he was teaching us by his behavior, everything for Krishna. When I do some service with the intention of pleasing Guru and Krishna, if someone criticizes me and finds fault in me, for example, my husband, I feel very sad and angry. Please tell me, how should I take this and see it as Krishna's arrangement? It's to help you become detached from marriage. You have a nice ashram. Just waiting for you. This is an invitation. No. Similar to, you know, the earlier question about someone does something hurtful. If you're in the grahastha ashram and your husband or wife say something that's hurtful, part of the responsibility in any relationship, certainly in household life, is to have some communication. But there's an art of how to have proper communication. And there's common ways that are not proper communication. And one of the proper ways of communication, I'll just put it in simple language, it's making I statements, meaning this happened, this is what was said, and this is what I felt. So you're sharing with your spouse, this is what I felt, or your friend, or another devotee, or whoever that you have a relationship with. The message is you take responsibility for your own feelings. You don't blame your feelings. You did this to me. You made me feel like this. The other person didn't make you feel like anything. Because of your own psychological makeup, you felt something. And you're sharing to that person you're in some relationship with, this is what I felt. I take full responsibility for my feelings. I'm communicating, this is what I felt. It would sure be nice if you, understanding this is how I feel when something like this happens, if we can reconsider how things can happen in the dynamic of our relationship. That would be very nice. And so rather than blaming and fault-finding and so on, you have a relationship and you're investing in the relationship by helping the other person understand what you're feeling. And good chance you'll hear, if you're open for it, you'll hear what they were feeling. And when they were feeling such and such, they expressed themselves in a certain way. And the reason they were feeling such and such has to do quite possibly with something unrelated to the exchange. And then you can work through that, whatever that something was that prompted them to speak the way or act the way that they did. Because you care about each other and you want to help each other. And your journey back to Godhead, that's what marriages, Krishna conscious marriages are for. And Krishna conscious friendships and the opportunity to serve amongst devotees. Somehow, if it's not my capacity to do so, that's okay. Then I accept that's from my side. I'm not going to blame somebody else for what I'm feeling. While waking up deities and doing offerings to deities, should we chant mantras loudly or softly? Somewhere in between. Audibly, because it's for the pleasure of the deity. But no, not so audibly that the altar shakes. And it depends also if you're, you know, if you have sleeping children or if you're in a temple, that there are devotees that are chanting japa in the temple room and, you know, social considerations, but something that's audible for the pleasure of the deity and time, place, and circumstance. We have 2 minutes left. A lot of paper here. While cultivating devotee relationships, we feel comfortable with some devotees and less open with other devotees. However, services may require that those two devotees, those that are not close with one another, they have to become a little closer than they are, develop a little deeper relationship than they have. So, to enhance that relationship between equals, it requires a self-created barrier to be overcome, and there's some inertia or fear associated in doing that. At least for me, in my neophyte nature, I have a competitive conditioned side to me. What should be a guiding principle that helps me enhance the relationship and also overcome conditionings that are blocking that relationship to go more deeply? Well, in 1 minute. This is a big question, a very important question, because interpersonal dynamics and common service together amongst devotees is where friction and, like this other, earlier question, hurt because of that friction can be felt. But we do common service together, so how to best, like before the hurt, how to proceed when I'm feeling cautious, maybe a little fearful, don't have a deep relationship. You can guaranteed that as you proceed, something will arise, just like in any relationship that you now have a close relationship with. There's always something that has to be worked out. So expect that to happen. Don't have the false anticipation, peaches and cream, with whipped cream on top. It's not going to be like that. There will be some little bump spots. That should be expected. First thing is, so that's don't have a false expectation. Within reason, not like blindly, but within reason, make a commitment to that, given the framework of what's been described here, make a commitment to that relationship, to invest in that relationship. So that's the second thing. Third thing is, incrementally go forward. Don't, from your side, rush or, you know, have impulsively try to, you know, cover a lot of territory very quickly. Commonly that doesn't work well. There's exceptions, but commonly that doesn't work well. So invest in the relationship and get to understand. One of the keys of a good relationship is try to understand the other person. Like that little quote that I read from Bhaktivedanta Swami, that little prayer that was, you know, rather than, this is a common statement of relationships or communication, seek first to understand. If you want to be understood, seek first to understand. Because it's natural what happens if you seek first to understand another person. They feel understood. Or at least somebody's trying to, they care enough about me, they're trying to understand. Wow, this is unique. And because you've tried to understand, there's some trust. And because there's some trust, and you've tried to understand them, you do have a better understanding of them, and so your communication in response will be more enlightened. And more sensitive and more tuned in to the other person. And so the words that you say may very well be different words than you would have chosen if you first tried to communicate rather than first tried to understand. It strengthens the relationship and strengthens communication. If you want to invest in a relationship, try to understand the other person. Show that you care about them. By enough that you try to understand them. So here's a topic. What do you think? What are your thoughts about this topic? I have some thoughts, but I'd like to hear your thoughts. And then you share your thoughts. You may find, I'm not sure I want to have a deeper relationship with this person because there's too many red flags. And so it may be better if I continue to be polite, but not more than that. Maybe that's part of the understanding that you're going to receive. But if you're doing common service together, one thing that should never disappear, and that is fundamental respect. That here's someone that's carrying bhakti in their heart. Let me respect that, because in this world, that's very special and rare. I'm respecting the soul because this soul is carrying bhakti in their bhakti vessel, their heart. I respect that. There's some other features that may attract me further or caution me to not go further. But I'm never going to lose that respect. This person is carrying bhakti. They have some attraction for Krishna. They want to do some service for Krishna. There may be some other things going on in there, but they want to do something for Krishna. I respect that. Don't lose that respect. Then there's no question of a relationship of any kind. If there's no respect, there's no relationship. Well, our time is up. And many of us have to go, well, some of us have to go not so far away, and some have to go really far away. So I'm going to end 5 minutes after one. I wish you all a safe journey going back to where you came from. And thank you all very much for coming. Did you get the feedback forms filled out, Anantashesh? Those of you that did, thank you very much. If you haven't done so yet, please feel invited to do so. Dhruv is here, now I can personally thank him for allowing the invasion of many hordes of people, and little ones and big ones and in-between ones coming here. Gidanagri is a very, very wonderful place. I hope there's going to be a clean-up team that cleans up after. Is that in place? Do you have any idea? Huh? The people already working to do the cleaning. Okay, well, Dhruva can give us a feedback on, you know, did the cleanup happen properly? Okay. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.